I can't remember a time that I sat in a chair and gave a Dharma talk in a chair here for our sitting groups. So might be interested to know why. On Wednesday, I had a bilateral hernia surgery. And so so I'm sore. And doing things slowly. So on Thursday, while I was resting in bed, recovering in bed, I heard some various commotion in the living room of our house. And what had happened was that our four-year-old son had gotten his hands on this little craft kit that is for making tie-dye t-shirts. And it has these little cords where the dye is in. I don't know how you use it, but anyway, the dye is in the cords. And he had put the dye in, he put the cord in his mouth. And his mouth was all blue. And my wife had noticed immediately, and so she immediately took him to the bathroom, had him not swallow anything, and she felt pretty confident she had 98% of the dye out of his mouth. But I was wondering about, you know, what the dye was. And we looked at the label of the craft kit. It didn't say what the dye was made out of, but it did say twice on the kit, do not put in the mouth. Call the doctor. And no contact with the eyes. You should wear gloves when you use the stuff. So that was, you know. So what I found out is apparently in this kind of circumstance, you call the poison control center. So I called the poison control center. And they tried to do some investigation, but the manufacturer was closed by that time. And they couldn't really find anything about it, but his opinion, that the control center, was that closed dye basically are pretty safe chemicals. There might be a lot of salts in it or something that might burn a little bit. But that, you know, unless my son started throwing up or got nauseous in the next hour, not to worry about it. So that was the advice. So, you know, okay. So he's fine. And that's the end of the story. But, you know, the so Buddhism is is kind of like a poison control center. And I think people regularly get poisoned. And then you need to know what to do. Some, you know, is it really poison? Is it, how dangerous is it? Is it fatal? Will you get over it? And so part of the function of Buddhism is to deal with the poisons that affect our lives, affect our hearts. And I think that Buddhism talks a lot about poison. And it can seem like a little bit of a downer to talk about poisons. But I think that the degree which Buddhism talks about poison, poisons of the heart, poisons of the mind, it does so, I think, with a very wholesome or positive view of the human heart and human mind. The human heart is beautiful, except when it's poisoned. And so it's helpful to know when you're poisoned. Sometimes it's hard to identify, to notice that's actually the case. Sometimes the effect of the poison is not evident until, you know, many times long later. But sometimes it's really obvious. And if you read some of the horrible things that can be read about in the newspaper or be seen about in our community, Buddhism says it all can be traced. All the man-made, man-caused, human-caused terrible things can be all be traced to three roots, the three root causes, to greed, hate, and delusion. And greed, hate, and delusion are sometimes called the three roots for unwholesome behavior, or sometimes for evil, for harm in the world. Sometimes these three, greed, hate, and delusion, are called the three poisons because they can cause poison. They can actually have cause tremendous harm to ourselves and to others. And sometimes they're fatal. And sometimes they're called the three fires. And they keep us agitated, keep the heart and mind kind of burning. So what I thought I would do today is talk a little bit about the third poison, which is the poison of delusion. And it's said that delusion is the most dangerous of the poisons and the most difficult to recognize. It's possible to clearly see greed as greed. It's possible to see hate as hate. But it's not so easy to see delusion as delusion, because one of the qualities of delusion is it believes it's true. And this sense of certitude, this is the way things are, comes along with delusion. And to some extent, delusion can be the underpinning or the support for greed and hate. You might have the delusion about who you are, some delusion about self-image of who you are. And in order to fulfill that self-image, support and maintain it, or defend it, you might give rise to greed or hate, some manifestation of it. But it begins with this delusion of self-image, that this is who I am. And there's a whole range of intensities to delusion, and it can happen at many different levels in the psyche, in the mind. And it can happen in ways which are somewhat subconscious, maybe even unconscious. Human beings have tremendous capacity at putting on blinders, at denial. And so in Buddhism, there's a whole complex of terms or concepts related to delusion. There's ignorance, there's confusion, there's illusion, delusion, and what else? Well, those are pretty good. And Buddhist practice is meant to address the issue of delusion, confusion, ignorance, illusion. And the clearest antidote to it is what's called wisdom or insight, prajna, panya. To somehow be able to see clearly what is going on. And so that's part of the reason for mindfulness, is to start seeing clearly, to break through the shell of delusion. In extreme forms, delusion is a psychiatric condition. And so there are delusions of, some of the lists in psychiatric world is like delusion of persecution. People are out to get you. And I remember once when I was at living at Green Gulch Zen Center, I was told that I was kind of like one of the director type. So I was told that there were these women up in the parking lot who had put bedding around their Volkswagen van, and they were doing something unusual behind that curtain in the van, and I should go up and look. So I went, looked, and kind of, knocked on the curtains and kind of peeked in, and they were taking everything out of their Volkswagen van and were in the engines underneath, and they were absolutely convinced that the FBI had planted a bomb in their van. And they were there to kind of find it and take care of it. So now, I suppose it's not impossible the FBI would do that, but I think that pretty unlikely. And when I started hearing more of the story, it seemed more and more unlikely that was the case. And an example of delusion, kind of delusion of persecution. There's delusion of grandeur that some people fall under. And the delusion of grandeur has all kinds of expressions, but somehow feeling that I'm really the best, I'm the greatest. And I suppose there's a negative side of that, the delusion of anti-grandeur. I'm the worst. No one else could be as bad as me. And it can be such a powerful delusion that that it really, affects the way people see the world and see themselves, and becomes a psychiatric condition. I feel certainly that, but it also can be much milder than a psychiatric condition. I mean, I feel like I've periodically had delusions of grandeur. I remember when I was relatively new Buddhist student, I would sit listening to my teacher's Dharma talks and think, well, I could give a much better talk than that. If I could, and I would kind of lose touch with what we were talking about, as I go off on my wonderful, profound talk in my mind. It's kind of a little bit delusion of grandeur. Delusions of being a savior, that I'm going to save people. That can be extreme, but also it can be kind of mild, where kind of delusions of being the helper. I'm going to help. There's delusions of thought transmission, all kinds of directions, feeling that we're projecting thoughts into other people's minds, delusions that people are projecting to my mind, that somehow we're communicating mind to mind. It's a pretty well-recognized psychiatric condition. It happens sometimes around Buddhist circles. I don't know, maybe it happens a lot of different places, but a lot of the Buddhist teachers I've known have had some occurrence of some person thinking, blaming that teacher for, oh, you're getting into my mind, leave me alone. There's delusions, it's called eromania. Some of you might know better than me. But it has to do with delusions of thinking that someone loves you who doesn't. Completely convinced this is the case, and then, behaving as if that's the case and getting into trouble. And it can happen in extreme levels where the police are needed, and then it can happen in pretty mild levels. And probably all of us at some point have succumbed to eromania. And I've told here sometimes the story of sitting a 3-month retreat at IMS, and it's a silent retreat, so you're not talking to anyone, but there was this woman sitting near me, and she was the one. And 3 months is a long time to let the fantasy build up. And so there was the first contact, and the first date, and the first, it goes on, and then there was marriage and kids and divorce. A lot can happen in 3 months. And I didn't take it that seriously, but I could see every once in a while the mind would wander off into this fantasy of this woman. And then at the end of the retreat, the silence was broken, and she spoke. And she had a very thick French accent. And when I heard that accent, the delusion was popped. Because I had spent 3 months assuming she was an American. And the whole image of, being in a relationship with her and everything, it was all based on her being a certain kind of person, an American person. And it was all illusion. And suddenly, I felt like I woke up. Wow, where have I been? What was that about? I don't know why human beings are prone to having delusion. I mean, there's probably many different reasons. Sometimes it's clear reasons. Sometimes maybe just what the human mind does. Sometimes it just makes up meaning and stories and projections. But sometimes it's very clear, it's a strategy. And sometimes delusion is a strategy to avoid feeling uncomfortable or feeling some difficulty in one's life. Or sometimes delusion is a strategy for trying to get something that otherwise we can't get, unless we kind of... in reality, we can't get it, but we delude ourselves as if it's going to happen there. Kind of denial. I think that there are people who sometimes don't go to the doctor when they should because they're kind of in denial. This is not really an issue. It's not really a big thing. And so they're kind of in denial about that. Or people who do the opposite. Every single itch, they go running to the doctor. This is really significant. I remember having a little itch on retreat in Burma. And I looked, and there was a little something on the skin. So there happened to be a dermatologist at the monastery. So I went and asked him if he would look at it. And he, with great sincerity, looked at it. And when he looked at it, basically he looked at me and said, "Are you crazy?" It was nothing, you know. And somehow in my mind, you know, those of you who have been on retreat know that there's something called yogi mind. And somehow the intensity of the concentration and the silence of the retreat, sometimes the delusions of the mind can appear much more strong than they can in normal life. So it's a little thing on my skin, you know. Big. There are social delusions. The whole society can have delusions. Families can have delusions. Delusions of denial. Pretending things are not what they're not. Pretending that things are not as they actually are. One of the great delusions is a whole class of delusions that are connected to being self-centered. Self-image. Selfish. And as if the world kind of circles around us. It's all about us. Everything's about us. And it can be quite interesting to spend some time doing an inventory of the kinds of thoughts that goes through your mind. And part of the value of doing mental noting, where you note, is you start seeing sometimes the patterns in your thinking that normally you wouldn't see because you're kind of caught up in the moment-to-moment experience of thinking. But you step back and look, well, what am I actually thinking? And it might be that primary themes are desire, the primary themes are aversion or hate, or one of the primary themes might be self-preoccupation. How does this relate to me? Me, myself, and mine. And if you find that you have a lot of thoughts that are self-referential, have to do about you, then you can start asking the question, is this really based on reality? Is this true? Is there delusion operating here in these self-image, self-thoughts, self-ideas? The whole idea of needs, the whole idea of how other people see us, what other people are doing towards us. There are delusions of blame. When things are not going well, some people have a very easy tendency to blame others, to get angry at others, and be outwardly directed. Some people's delusive mind tends to focus the blame inwardly at ourselves. Some people, the mind goes off into fantasy when things are not going well. And some people in defensive ways. So I think one of the great studies in developing insight is to look at the whole complex of things having to do with self-image. And I think it's very difficult to do. But if you get a handle on that, you get a handle into the world of kind of the other side of delusion. It's hard to do because sometimes our society and friends and family support certain delusions, certain erroneous ideas about who we are. When I first started meditating, I was living with a couple of friends, meditating regularly every morning. And I'd come down to breakfast after meditating, and the usual sense of guilt wasn't operating. I had no motivation to kind of present myself in a certain way, or be seen a certain way, or anything particular happen. So I showed up at breakfast kind of very calm, and kind of feeling somewhat calm, maybe empty. And over the next mornings, my friends got more and more uncomfortable. And I realized, because of the lack of skill that I had at that point, that either I had to stop meditating or lose my friends. So I chose my friends at that point over my meditation. And so I stopped meditating and started behaving as the usual Gil, as they expected. But it was kind of like, you know, going back to a delusion that was comfortable. There's a delusion around self, around the self has particular needs. So I need X, Y, and Z. I need all kinds of things. And our society kind of has powerful messages of what the self needs, what you need, what a human being needs. And it's very easy to internalize that. So, you know, last month I was on retreat in a cabin, solitary retreat by myself. And one of the things that struck me during this time was how little I consumed, how little I needed. They gave me very little food every day. They brought food to the cabin basically once a day. And the first couple of days I thought, this is very little. You know, how could I manage? But by the third or fourth day, I thought, they're bringing me too much food. Very, very little. You know, the way I work on retreat, I tend to eat very little. And I didn't need a television. I didn't need a computer. I didn't need a telephone. I didn't need any books. I didn't need, basically all I needed was my cushions to sit on. You know, I needed a bed to sleep on. But it was very, very little that I needed. And then I come back here to the society, and it's so easy just to have the desires coming up. And it's one thing to have desires. Oh, I would like to have this and that. But the desires can come along with delusion. This is going to fulfill me. If I can have this, then everything will be okay. So the delusion of externalizing our happiness. If somehow the world can provide a certain thing, the world can be a certain way, or I can get a certain things, I can acquire certain things, then I can be happy. And I remember, maybe all of you had this experience, but I remember what comes to mind is when I was about this age of my 9-year-old son, I really wanted a few I remember wanting some things for Christmas. Once I wanted a toy machine gun. And, it's a beautiful kind of plastic machine gun. And my parents weren't that into giving it to me. But I really wanted it. It was so important, you know. I was like, ha, ha. And so they succumbed, I guess. And they gave me this beautiful, you know, ornate, you know, state-of-the-art toy plastic machine gun, the way they could make them in the 1960s. And as soon as I had it, I lost interest in it. I thought it was going to fulfill me. But then, once I had it, you know, it had no meaning at all. And people can spend, you know, decades pursuing certain illusions, that this is going to do it for me. I can have this thing. If I can have a house. If I can have the perfect relationship. There is a perfect relationship out there to be had. There's a Mullah Nasruddin story that I'm sorry I can't remember so well. Maybe some of you remember better, but where Mullah says, you know, oh, I've never been able to have a really find the right woman for me. You know, I went to Damascus and I heard there was this beautiful woman there who had all these qualities that would be perfect for me. But when I saw her, I found out that she couldn't cook. And then I heard that in Cairo there was this, you know, woman who was perfect for me. And I went there, but her eyes weren't blue. And then I went to Baghdad and, you know, and there was, she almost had it right, but, you know, almost, but she had the wrong accent. And then, finally, Istanbul, I found the perfect woman. It was just everything I could have wanted, a woman was there. Oh, great. So you married her and were happy ever after? No, she wasn't interested in me. But it can cause a lot of pain in relationships. The idea that to hold someone up, a partner up to some ideal, this is what a person should be like. Part of the approach in Buddhism is to have a very deep respect for how things actually are, how a person is, how you are, what the situation is. And I use the word respect carefully. It's not the same thing as appreciation. It's not the same thing as acceptance. Respect means that you're willing to look at it more carefully. The etymology of the word is respect is to look again, to look more carefully, to respect. And so the respect is to look more carefully. What is really here? Try to understand, what is this? Can you see through the veil of our opinions, interpretations, our ideas? What is this really going on here? And the same thing with ourselves, to look at ourselves, to look at ourselves. Now, I think it's very hard for most people to be honest about themselves. If it was easy to be honest about ourselves, I think we would all get enlightened a lot faster. It'd be pretty easy. I think if it was easy to be honest with ourselves, it would be a lot easier to get concentrated, get really settled in meditation pretty quickly. And I think that, I think honesty is a synonym for mindfulness. And it's easy to be deluded about how honest we are. It's easy to be deluded about how wise we are. It's easy to be deluded about how by our behavior, but why it's okay to do certain things. Oh, it's okay, you know. I'm wise enough. I can handle this. I can negotiate this particular difficulty, this particular awkwardness. So the Buddhist practice, offers a whole rich approach to the spiritual life that's much more than just sitting down to meditate and being mindful. And I would say that probably mindfulness is not enough by itself for most people, maybe for everyone. So one of the things is Buddhism has a whole bunch of lists, which somehow aren't always so inspiring to go through the lists. But part of the function of these lists is to help us make inventory of ourselves, to help us look at ourselves more carefully. And I use the word inventory because of how it's used, I think, in 12-step recovery programs. I think it's a very powerful phenomenon, the 12-step. And one of the things you do in 12-step is you do, I think it's the 5th step, is that right? Or the 4th step? 4th step, where you do a moral inventory of your life. And you go through your life. You go back and earliest memories you have sometimes and kind of go through very carefully and try to kind of really take in what it is you've done. Have you harmed anyone through your life? And for some people who do this, it's a shock to actually go through it, because they've never done that. And to be like, wow, I had no idea. This adds up. It's one thing to remember here or there, I did, this one thing at some point, but this adds up. Boy, I had no idea. Not only does it add up, but there's a real pattern here. It looks like over and over and over again, I get angry with people. And that seems to be, of course, they're to blame. Of course. But, this is a real pattern. Or pursuing desire and harming some people because of our wanting to pursue our desire. So I think it's very, very powerful to do some like this inventory thing. And even if you feel like you don't need it, I think that it's very helpful to do things that test you. Part of the reason to go on retreat in Buddhism, if you do meditation for a while, and you've been on retreats for a while, and then you think, oh, I'm great, everything's wonderful, life is kind of smooth, nice. And then I tell people, you should go and retreat. Try it. Go for a week-long, 10-day retreat and see what goes on. Let it be a test. And sometimes the retreat goes beautifully, but sometimes the function of retreat is to highlight or show or reveal aspects of our life which we've been ignoring, not paying attention to, deluded about. Certain tendencies which kind of are working in daily life, we think are working, but when we do our own retreat, it becomes clear this doesn't work. things become really, the retreat reveals the problems or difficulties or the self-delusion in our life quite powerfully. And so part of the function of these lists in Buddhism, like the five precepts, or the five hindrances, or the three poisons, is to use them as an aid to doing an inventory, to take them seriously and say, what are the ways, how does it that I relate to these precepts? How do they live out in my life? How have they lived out in my life in the past? Do I really live by them? Not as a way of having kind of a moralistic judgments about oneself, but rather as a kind of a wedge or a tool to help kind of break open the phenomenally creative ways in which the human mind can fool itself for what's going on. And then another aspect of Buddhist practice that helps with delusion is to practice in a community of people. To have other people who you share your practice with. And it's very easy to be, in doing a spiritual practice, to be deluded about the level of your attainment when you're alone. And but when you're living with other people, you know, it's quite humbling. Have children. I mean, I've been humbled so much. And certain ideas that I had about my level of attainment or how calm I could stay or how, you know, little I would really succumb to anger. Oh, I'd overcome my anger long ago, thank you. But then I had children. And that showed me wasn't the case. Or living community. I found it very, very helpful to be part of various communities. I find it helpful to be part of this community. But I've been part of many Buddhist communities. And it's that living together, like rubbing up against each other, having things not go the way that I want them to go, in a situation where you have to kind of talk about things and work things out, not just walk away, that or ignore people, that actually help reveal and show aspects of myself that I didn't know. So one thing I've mentioned here a few times is when I was living at the Buddhist monastery Tassajara, I was in various work situations that were quite intense, for example in the kitchen, being the kitchen manager. And when I became the kitchen manager, it became really clear to me in a way that I had no idea, I didn't even know it was an issue for me until then, that I was driven by the desire to have people like me. It's okay to have people like you. It's okay to kind of, you know, be kind so they like you. It's within reason, right? But you can be driven by it. And I would do these amazing social gymnastics so they try to get people to kind of like me in the kitchen, which was a very hard place to have people like you. And because if you told them, because, the, you know, anyway. Someone once told me, who worked under me in the kitchen, he said, "Gil, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out." That was kind of mixed. Mixed praise. So I suffered a lot because of this desire to want people to like me. And when I suffered, because I had so many chances in the kitchen, you know, it happened so often, this need, and we were working together so closely, I got to see it in ways that I couldn't see it elsewhere in my life. And so I had to really confront this issue in my life. I had to really deal with it. And it was a very important turning point for me because as long as you're kind of caught by this hook of wanting to be liked by people, wanting to be seen a certain way, they have control over you, they have power over you. Or you give them power or something. You lose your own power, your own autonomy. But then there's the delusion of autonomy, right? I'm going to be in control. I can be autonomous. And And that doesn't work sometimes. You know, that can cause a tremendous amount of suffering as well. It's up to me. I think part of the great aspect of being in a Buddhist community or spiritual community is the feeling, the ability to get support and help, get feedback, to have people we can be honest with, and hopefully have people we can share some of what we think is our darkest or deepest secrets or shadows or things that are most uncomfortable to reveal to anybody else. Both Buddhism and 12-step have the understanding that certain kinds of behavior that we do, certain kind of tendencies, are very hard to overcome or atone from unless there's some kind of way we tell someone else about it. Maybe kind of like confession, but you tell someone else, you have someone else be a witness that you are no longer going to do this, or a witness that you've actually acknowledging that this is to yourself. You're acknowledging, this is something I've done. I'm not going to stand by this anymore. I'm not going to participate in this. If you don't tell someone else what you've done, then it's very easy sometimes to get to fool oneself. Oh, I really dealt with this. You know, or I can manage. I can, you know, whatever. And to have people to talk to about these things. So I think the whole package of Buddhist practice is a way to help us get into underneath the delusions, so we can see them as delusions, break through them, these illusions. And it's also, and also the whole package is kind of a safeguard and a test for us ourselves, so that when we think that everything's going well, we're willing to put ourselves in situations where we get tested and be challenged. If you're never willing to be challenged in a deep way, then the chances are that there's delusion. So one of the aspects of Chinese Zen, I don't know if it's still the case, but in the ancient times, was after a Buddhist monk or nun, it's been years of practice, they were sent out to wander around the different monasteries of China to visit some of the great teachers in order to test their understanding. And they would, you know, they'd come and challenge the great teacher, or they present themselves with their understanding, and the great teacher would say, you know, respond in some way, maybe challenge them back or poke a hole in their understanding or do something. So to go around and give teachers, you know, find teachers and give them a chance to kind of poke holes at you or pull the rug from under you. Maybe they won't. Maybe your understanding is impeccable. Your realization is superb. But maybe it's not. Sometimes maybe there's nothing wrong with your understanding, but you've fooled yourself into how deeply you've integrated into your life. And so the teacher might say, well, it's very good, your understanding. Thank you. It's really good. Really good. But I think that what you need to do is go get a job in a kindergarten. And come back in a year and we'll talk about what happened. Or, you know, or just get a job. I think what you need is get a job. No, let's see how that is. Or maybe what you need to do is travel. I love Trungpa's quote. If you can't meditate, travel. Sometimes traveling is a relief, but sometimes traveling is a great challenge. If you've always lived a certain way, challenge yourself to live a different way for a while, even if it's a week. If you've always lived together with people, live alone for a while, completely alone. If you mostly live alone all the time, find some circumstance where you can live together with people. You know, and see what that does, see what it reveals about yourself. So delusion. Delusion is really common. And one of the, I think, for me, one of the great perspectives that Buddhism gives to this issue of delusion is that you don't have to take delusion as something personal, as a personal failing. We can think of delusion as it comes with being a human being. Human minds somehow are designed to be delusive. Some people are more delusive than others, but it's kind of what the mind does. Maybe it has evolutionary advantage to be delusive. But, you know, that part of evolution history is over for us, so now we can wake up. And so, but not to take it personally, not to take it as a personal failing, but rather, and not something you have to hide or be embarrassed about, but rather, you know, maybe willing to talk about it, be willing to be transparent. There was a time in my practice, I believe that when I was living at Zen Center, where in order to help with all this delusion and everything, I kind of made a commitment for a period of time to be an open book to people. If anything people asked me, I was going to tell them. I wasn't going to volunteer out of the blue, because that's then people get oppressed, right? You know, let me tell you about myself. But if anybody asked me anything about myself, I was going to tell them as transparently as I could, this is how it is. And it was a very interesting experiment or time in my life to try to do that, to have that transparency, to see, you know, to have it come out and have other people witness it. It wasn't always easy to do it that way. But it was very freeing to do that. So to appreciate that some of these, like that delusion can also be a poison and a fire that can cause tremendous harm. And to be motivated to live a life which doesn't cause harm. To be motivated to have a life that actually is for the welfare and happiness of all beings. And to have that motivation, to use that motivation to help us to be really, to find ways to be really clear and honest about delusion in our life. Use our community, use the teachings, use our friends, use the teachers to help us and be willing to be challenged in this regard. Just as I didn't need it, so I needed so little on my retreat. It's remarkable how little the human heart needs in order to be happy. It's okay to give your delusions away. It's really okay. You can be happy without them. So, thank you very much. And excuse me, I want to say one more thing. Maybe it's too brief, but to really get the point across. In some schools of Buddhism, they teach that Zen Master Dogen said, something like, to be deluded about enlightenment is delusion. To be enlightened about delusion is enlightenment. Something like that. So maybe one of the illusions or one of the hang-ups is the idea that you have to be rid of all your illusions and delusions. Only then can you be a good person, liked by everybody. You don't have to necessarily get rid of your delusions, but there's a kind of way of waking up when you see them for what they are. There's a way there. Oh, that is an illusion. That's an illusion. I see it. It's still there. It's lingering there, but now I see it. I'm not fooled by it. So don't fall under the illusion that you have to get rid of all these things, but rather you have to see through them and thereby find some freedom. Thank you, and I hope some of you will stay for tea and we can chat a little bit more.